today, and she was an Atkin Fellow from October to February earlier this year. So over to you, Amal.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
And thank you all for being here, and it's an honor to be here today to chair this afternoon session. We're going to discuss a very hot topic, hot issue, the Palestinian issue, so hopefully all of you will be in full attention. Allow me to introduce our speakers. To the far end, we have Mr. Yasser Qatarni. He's the president of Third Way Institute, and previously he served as the Director General of the Regional Center for Conflict Prevention at the Jordan Institute of Diplomacy. And on my right, we have Dr. Izzeddin Shoukry. He's the former advisor to the Egyptian foreign minister. And before that, the UN envoy to the Middle East. The former advisor to the Egyptian foreign minister.
And to the UN envoy.
Yes.
I welcome the UN envoy.
Yes. Yeah. And to the UN envoy. And he's a famous Egyptian writer and a professor of international relations at the American University in Cairo. And to my left, we have Dr. Sabri Saidam. He's the advisor to the president, to the Palestinian president, and he was the former minister of technology and IT. Today, we will discuss. Now, we will discuss the. Palestinian perspective on advancing the peace process. Let me start with Mr. Qatarni. Mr. Qatarni, we know that Jordan has been a pioneer in advancing peace negotiations in the region, not only between Palestinians and Israelis, but also in the region. However, currently we are witnessing slightly a step back from Jordan, and where it is trying to play the role of the observer instead of being an active player. Why do you think is this situation or position is happening now?
Thank you, Amal. Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you, Peter, and the whole staff of ICSR for such an important opportunity to be able to talk and address such an audience. Actually, I don't think Jordan would ever be able to afford to be only an observant to the peace process, to its Western sphere, meaning the West Bank and Israel. Given the historical relationship and demographically, of course, geographically as well, between Jordan and the West Bank, and Israel with the Arab and Palestinian who left in 1948 towards Jordan, I don't think Jordan can ever afford to be just merely unobservant of the situation. However, we have to admit that in the last few years, actually almost in the last decade, the whole peace process was not that high on the agenda of, let's say, and put it bluntly, of Washington D.C. and the Bush administration. Having said that, also Jordan has always feared that one day, after signing a peace treaty with Israel, with an Israeli partner back in 1994, that the so-called Jordanian option will disappear from the agenda. As we were told back in 1994 by the Jordanian delegation who participated in the peace talks with the Israelis, when they came back to Amman, some of them acted as conquerors when they said that we have buried the Jordanian option once and for all. Recently, after 2006, things have changed into a direction where many started to question in Jordan. The dead is awake again, and just recently we had governmental officials and members of the Knesset talking and addressing the Jordanian option again, which falls 100% against the ultimate national interest of Jordan and the Palestinians as well. So this makes me more convinced that there is no way Jordan will ever be just an observer. In fact, Jordan will always continue to be very active in this process, and I don't think that Jordan will be willing to do any effort other than pushing to the table a two-state solution that will end up with having an independent, sovereign, viable Palestinian state that will allow Jordan to function and get more involved in the West Bank with an independent partner, rather than just finding itself suddenly engaged and involved in a process in the West Bank that nobody wishes to be there, with all the mess that is already existing on a political and security level in the West Bank and Gaza. So I have to say that from a Jordanian perspective, and not the Jordanian perspective, I'm here to just present a perspective from Jordan. I think that Jordan must make sure always that unless there is a Palestinian partner in the West Bank that is politically fully functioning in a sovereign way, Jordan should always try to avoid to be pushed in what I feel and believe could be potentially a big trap, to find itself basically having to clean after all the messes that have been a result, actually, by the Israeli politics and to a certain extent the faction and the disunity that we have among the Palestinian players in the West Bank and Gaza, i.e. Fatah and Hamas. How to do so, in my opinion, Jordan should always consider that there are non-state actors that are very important as players in this process, in the Israeli-Palestinian process, and here I mean Hamas, that should not be excluded if Jordan really want to secure a future where we have an independent Palestinian state. And therefore, I think also on a regional level that the new Middle East, having Condoleezza Rice coming up with this term, the new Middle East, I will add another new in order to distinct myself from Condoleezza Rice. The new Middle East is basically about new actors that are forcing themselves into the arena, and these actors happen to be very active in the realm of the Israeli-Arab conflict, whether we're talking about Hezbollah in Lebanon or we're talking about Hamas in the Palestinian territories. So I don't think any future settlement will be viable if we continue to ignore and exclude and try to push aside such non-state actors, unless we have them included, unless in the case of Palestine we make sure that a unified government in the West Bank and Gaza that represent all Palestinians and that could be a viable partner for any peace process, we will never reach an end for this conflict. And we just cannot live in a Middle East where these non-state actors are silenced and excluded. Now, in order to do so, many will think that how on earth we can talk to terrorist organizations that don't want to basically play in the game And I think there is a big misperception in this case, especially when we talk about Hamas and Hezbollah in the context of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Hamas and Hezbollah are not just a terrorist organization. They are political actors that mainly want to maximize their interest and their shares in the political table, if we look at the political system as a table, as a metaphor. And thus, we have to act to and react to this in this context. They are not Al-Qaeda. They are not just merely a terrorist organization who want to destroy the table. So our approach should fundamentally change towards these organizations, especially in the case of the Palestinian example, and not look at Hamas just as simply a terrorist organization that is not interested in reaching a peace settlement for its people in the future. I think fundamentally this has to be changed, and to perceive Hamas as a potential partner that could be dealt with and should and must be included if we want to reach a settlement that will be enduring and be viable. And thus, in my personal opinion, I think Jordan should act accordingly and make sure that Hamas is not going to be left out for other non-Arab actors in the Middle East, if I want to be clear, Iran. And this is as far as the Palestinian part of the formula is concerned, and as for the Israeli part of the formula, the other part of the formula is concerned, the Jordanians must always make sure to their Israeli partners that the Jordanian option, the insistence of talking about the Jordanian option as having Jordan, the homeland for the Palestinians, means annulment of the peace treaty, that Israel is not interested in maintaining peace with its Jordanian partner because it goes totally against the national interest of Jordan to have such opinion being dominating the political debate in Israel. And this is, in my opinion, how Jordan should, of course, briefly, unfortunately we don't have the time here, but briefly, should approach any future, or at least approach the peace settlement within the Israeli-Palestinian context in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kafarani. Dr. Shukri, we know that the Obama administration is aiming at revising the peace process. And we all know that Egypt has been an active player in designing the Arab Peace Initiative. So in the light of what His Excellency the Israeli ambassador has been saying about, you know, the Arabs should play an active role, in a way or another. So how do you think Egypt can mobilize Arabs to revive this Arab peace initiative and to bring it to reality and to implement it?
Thank you. Thank you. I'll answer your question in the context of a few points I want to make. But before doing this, I think the first point I'd like to make is to emphasize that the Middle East is a very crowded place, and the Middle East conflict and conflict resolution efforts have been going on for quite some time. And for anyone to deal with the Middle East, you'll be confronted with endless views and myths and some insignificant statements about Middle East conflict and what can be done and what should be done. And I will begin by trying to dispel some of those myths and insignificant statements in my view, and then move to how, if we want to make it work, how can we make it work. I think the first myth is to attribute the lack of progress towards peace to the current Palestinian drift. the conflict between Hamas and Fatah, or to Palestinian radicalism. I think if we want to be accurate, Palestinian unity, there was a Palestinian unity at some time. There was at least a dominant Palestinian group at a long time, and that didn't necessarily result in us making huge progress. Even with Hamas government in Gaza, or de facto authority, everybody's lamenting the fact that Hamas is rejectionist. But if you think about it, there was actually no peace for Hamas to reject. Hamas rejected a process, or rejected a promise to enter a process, but as it wasn't Tron, somebody else said, I think, this morning, the idea that you go in another process has nothing to do with making peace. A process is a charade. So it has been a charade for a long time. So if you look at Hamas and the actual political choices Hamas was forced to make, there was no peace offer, there was no credible peace offer that Hamas rejected. The quartet said, if Hamas behaves, do one, two, three things, it will be accepted in the club of civilized people. But the quartet didn't say, if Hamas does one, two, three, there will be a Palestinian state on these borders with these attributes. This offer, this credible offer, has always been lacking. So the radicalism is a problem. I'm not saying it's a happy fact of life. It is a problem, but it is not the obstacle that we're facing today if we want to progress to peace. A second myth is about Arab Peace Initiative and confidence-building measures. Dennis Ross is one of the architects of these myths. Dennis is a great guy, but I think he's wrong on this one. The idea that if the Arabs are a little bit nicer, if the Saudis would meet with the Israelis, if school kids will go and play together, then some confidence will be built and then we can all make peace and be happy. Wrong. That's not the approach, for various reasons. One is political realities in the Arab world are also important, because political leaders have to take cost for their action. And for any politician to take a costly action, the politician needs a payoff. And if there is no payoff, the politician is not going to do it. This rule is right in Israel, it is right in Europe, it is right also in the Arab world. So why would I pay as a Saudi king or anyone, why would I pay political capital if there is nothing in return? What do I get? Remember Annapolis. I sent my foreign minister, royal crown, you know, long title, Saud al-Faisal, to Annapolis. What do I get in return? So there is a diminishing desire on the Arab world to take or to make gestures like this, because there is no something tangible at the end that for sure we will get. And I think probably the same is applicable to Israel in terms of confidence building measures. A third myth is, if we just get the two parties to sit together and we restart negotiations, we will get peace. Again, I think it's completely wrong. The two sides have been sitting together formally since Madrid. And we haven't. And, you know, various governments. We had Labour, we had Likud, we had hawkish, we had less hawkish, we had peace-loving Palestinians, we had others. The two sides, we need to face that. Not only the two sides, but including the other Arab states. The sides, the parties, are incapable alone of reaching a peace agreement. They will not, on their own, reach a peace agreement. I'm not saying a peace agreement should be imposed. I'm saying if you lock them together for as long as you want, they will not be able to make the needed compromises. Everyone knows where the compromises are, more or less, with huge margins. But they know what the compromises are. But no one is going to spill out. The Palestinians are not going to say anything meaningful on refugees unless they hear something meaningful on Jerusalem and borders. And the Israelis are not going to say anything meaningful on these, because they will fear that the Palestinians would run away and pocket it. And then the negotiations will end, and whatever you've said in the negotiation room will become already something that you have for your next round. We have seen various forms and formats And even with Abu Mazen, Olmert in a locked room, the two of them together, still it is impossible for the parties to spill out those. So with all due respect to what Senator Mitchell is doing, if he ends up using all his political capital in order to get a settlement freeze that I am telling you in advance, it is not going to be complete. There will never be a complete settlement freeze in Israel. And the Likud government can drown Mitchell and the U.S. administration in details forever on what a settlement freeze is, which tender has been already approved, which work has already started, where is the settlement, is in Jerusalem, those are settlements, etc., etc. So you spend all your political capital on getting a confidence-building measure that will be, at best, a half-hearted measure. Then the Arabs will use this as a pretext not to take gestures towards Israel. And then finally you get everybody to a negotiation room and everybody's tired, politically used their capital. And then you have a Madrid all over again. And for those who were there or who studied it, you know, the Madrid exercise, with all the publicity we have, wasn't really a very substantive negotiation process between the parties. I'll go very quickly now on the insignificant things. Insignificant things are: Syria is an authoritarian regime, Egypt is going to collapse, and the Palestinians are teaching their kids bad things and they teach them to hate Jews and all. All this might be true or not. It is irrelevant. We're making peace among enemies. And the most important thing is to make a, is to create a political and security framework that would calm everybody down, would create a framework and a context for people to come in lately. If you want to educate your public, good luck with that. But don't expect peace to happen soon, because, you know, public education, civic education takes a very long time. And if you have doubts, ask the Germans about it. Now, I don't want to, you know, just be negative. So I'll tell you, in my view, how you can move. And I just want to say, before I say how we can move forward, I want to say this conflict has been on for more than 100 years, give or take, in various forms. And I think it is possible to resolve it. But I also think that it can continue. And the sky is not going to fall. It will be painful. More people will get killed. There will be instability in the Middle East. There is cost. But just it is possible that this conflict continues to unfold. It is not going to resolve itself on its own. You know, good things happen when good people make them happen. It takes a lot of investment for this to happen. But don't make mistakes. Don't think, you know, one party is dead, desperate to get a solution. You know, both sides have demonstrated their ability to endure and to live with conflicts. Now, if you want to move this forward, I think the only way to do it is for the international community, led by the U.S. and nobody else, led by the U.S. but supported actively by the Europeans and the usual suspects, UN and Russia and all those, is to come up with a declaration of principles. Say, those are the principles for a settlement in the Middle East. This is how we see a solution to the Middle East. Everybody knows the border will be based on 67, the stuff that Mark Ott said. This is how, those are the principles according to which the refugees' issues will be resolved. Those are the principles for a security structure in the Middle East. The principles, not a peace agreement, not a map, not a new security organization. The principles according, don't die now. The principles according to which the parties will then sit together and negotiate detailed agreement. Without those principles, nothing is going to happen. If you have those principles, and of course you have to do them in consultation with the parties, but not, you know, not make yourself hostage to the parties. Once you have this, you force everyone to show his or her true colors. Hamas will have then to decide, does it want a state? Or does it want to be perpetual something organization? Does it want to lose the Palestinian public? Because we know the majority of the public wants a state on the 67 border. Does it want to or not? Israel will have to decide. And will have to. And Israel also will see the upside in a peace agreement, because it includes, you know, principles of normal relations with the Arab world, you know, all the things. And Israelis will have to see there is security or not. There is international support or not. There is Arab buying in or not. and this is what you have to pay in return. This is your peace and security in Israel. And then make up your mind. And everyone else will have to, this will be the moment of truth. But again, as I said, you know, this can happen, or we can just, you know, continue on having conferences and meetings about how to resolve it in 30 years from now. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very comprehensive analysis. Thank you for that. Dr. Sabri, within the current situation of this tragic split between the two parts of the of Palestine, and within this split, and you know, the Egyptian efforts to reconstruct this relation between Palestinians, as an advisor to the Palestinian president, from your own perspective, how can we move forward from here? First, to revive the peace process, and secondly, to bridge the gap between the two sides of the country.
Well, thanks, Amal. They often say that the last speaker is the luckiest, because half of the audience will be suffering from the so-called digestion coma after a serious lunch. So being a last speaker in the last panel is certainly a major benefit. I want to go through three questions that I have put, and I believe, according to the notes, I can speak for 5 minutes. And I would like to address the question of figures in Palestine. So one has a photographic shot as to what's happening on the ground in Palestine. And apologies if the previous panel had mentioned some of the figures, but I would like you to be in the picture. As you know, the size of the West Bank and Gaza stands at 6,000 square kilometers. And the population, according to the last census, stands at almost 4 million. 44% of Palestinians are refugees within Palestine. 44% of the population have been displaced and are refugees within Palestine. 44% of Palestinians in the diaspora are refugees. Gaza population density stands at 4,000 persons per kilometer. In Israel, this stands at 334 persons per square kilometer. We have 144 major settlements housing almost over 500,000 settlers. The wall that was talked about, and I would like to address the wall during question time, the wall length is 771 kilometers, and by the way, the green line is 330 kilometers. So it's double the length of the green line. The water available for Palestinians is in the ratio of 1 to 8. 1 liter for Palestinian, 8 liters for Israelis. 25% of the population in the West Bank and Gaza has been collectively at one stage imprisoned. 57.3% of Palestinian families live below poverty level. Over 600 checkpoints exist in the West Bank. The collection and the accumulation of the scene as it stands, talking about whether it includes checkpoints, settlements, roadblocks, and what have you, has created what I would like to call more of a Swiss cheese kind of enclave or entity. And this addresses heads on the question of viability, whether there is indeed a viable land to accommodate a viable Palestinian state. 20% of the Gaza Strip is now destroyed, awaiting reconstruction, with people growing more and more despaired by the day. Commercial deficit over the years 2006 as compared to, or 2007 as compared to 2006 has increased by 10%. I love to think of Palestine sometimes as the land of processes. You have a peace process, but at the end of the day you have the process, but you don't have the peace. And we have recently experienced a democratic process between Hamas and Fatah, and Hamas took over, but yet the international community was quick to acknowledge the process, but yet no democracy that prevailed in Palestine, certainly not the results of democracy, were acknowledged. In answer to the question that Amal posed, where do we take it forward, I would like to say that coming from Palestine, just now, the big slogan that every Palestinian carries is deeds, not words. Khalas, we've had enough with promises. We have had so many declarations. We're good in putting people on the map. We have put Oslo on the map. We have put Tenet on the map. We have put Mitchell on the map. We have put the roadmap on the map. We put things on the map, but yet no Palestine on the map. So khalas, no more declarations of principles, no more fancy English vocabulary to go with any process that's to be done. Palestinians want the end of occupation, period. The end of occupation, that's it. So serious effort would have to be exerted on the part of the international community. Certainly America's new vision would have to be supported. But there's a lot of blame as well, and I wish Tony Blair was here today so to hear what I have to say. There's a lot of blame on the part of the quartet that's not doing enough. It's waiting what the Americans are doing and then reiterating the message. We would have to go hand in hand. The international community would have to come and say enough is enough. The two sides would have to accomplish peace for the sake of their children and generations to come. There has to be an acceptance of the need of peace to exist, and not the process as I mentioned. There has to be the acceptance of the need to end the occupation that I mentioned also. We need to empower the peace camps. Talking about Fatah and Hamas, you're well aware that Fatah has adopted the policy of, or adopted the approach of peace, and has come a long way, and even some critics in Palestine say that the present of Hamas is the past of Fatah, the school of thought. The affirmity of opinion on the need to liberate Palestine, whatever slogans we have, we will have to think, rethink and revisit the concept of empowering the peace camp. Fatah has to produce to its people some results on the ground so people buy the concept of peace. So far they have seen more extension of walls, an increase in settlements, an increase in checkpoints. To them there is no peace. There is talk and there is empty delivery on previous promises. Now I think they've reached an age of 15 years old, or even more, since 1993. We have to apply the policy of accommodation, and here we'd have to be careful. When we address the question of Hamas, there's always sensitivity on the part of even my colleagues and comrades when it comes to Hamas. But we will have to face the music. There is extremists in Israel, but they're part of government. There is people in Palestine who are not acknowledged to be part of government. And I will talk about the Hamas Fatah rift because I feel strongly personally about it. There's an importance to accommodate Hamas. And there's an importance to accommodate Syria. And there's an importance even to accommodate Iran. And now Obama is in Russia because there's a perception that this policy of accommodation will have to be utilized for the benefit of peace building. This collision course has to end somehow, and people will have to basically fall into space to build a brighter picture in the Middle East. Now, what I want to say is that we need to utilize regional powers. And on the question of Syria, you know, the American administration was very keen to work towards Syria. Jim Feltman of the American administration has visited Damascus 3 times. Abu Mazen convinced Mitchell to visit Damascus once. There's an interest, but this interest would have to be developed somehow. So Syria has its powers over Hezbollah. Syria has its powers over Hamas. And this policy of accommodation again is achieved. We should never turn our back to the Palestinian inner problems. I hear some Israelis say, "Khalas, let them kill each other. We're happy, we're sitting tight, we're maintaining the state of Israel, let them go to hell." But trust me, my friends, trouble in your backyard is trouble at home. You can never sit tight and say, "Forget it." I tell you, because my family lives in Gaza, there's 1.5 million Palestinians. Now half of them sit on the fence, but the other half have evolved to become extremists. You will have to be careful. You will have to make a sharp and swift decision as to what you want the kids in Gaza to grow to be. I think we will have to come to the rescue of the Palestinian scene in a way that even the Israelis find benefit in a Palestinian reconciliation, so consensus is achieved should the peace process restarted and should a peace arrangement come to the scene. We will have to start implementing the Arab Peace Initiative, and I know the reservation of Hamas on that. But the Arab Peace Initiative is also conditional. It says if Israel acknowledges this, we will acknowledge that. So it's conditional and bears no responsibility on any party. Nobody can come and say, oh, if I acknowledge the Arab Peace Initiative, then I'm giving too much in too little time. I would need to negotiate. As I said, people have grown with despair and they need action. One last point is the Jewishness of the State of Israel. I'm very fearful. Even one of my friends has been very forthcoming in saying, I feel sorry for Israel because Israel needs help. If we get to address the issue of Jewishness of the State of Israel, then we will have to address a bigger question. Are we on for the policy of cohabitation or the policy of total separation? The wall in Palestine, although physical, it's creating a moral wall between the two nations. And is this the future of the Middle East? I think this is a major question that needs to be addressed. One final point on Hamas and Fatah, and I answer your first question. I think one of the biggest mistakes that Palestinians ever made is to fight each other. And one of the biggest mistakes, and I feel ashamed of being a Palestinian at this time, at this era, witnessing a Palestinian-Palestinian internal rift and inner fighting. We will have to move as fast as we can to end this, and I certainly hope and I commend our Egyptian colleagues on their efforts to draw the two sides together. I certainly hope that on the 25th of July there will be some revival of some hope, because the message in the Palestinian street is not security anymore. It's not ending the occupation. It's not food security anymore. It's the question of Palestinian-Palestinian unity. You won't believe how the mood fluctuates when it comes to meetings in Cairo, and there's good statements coming through the different media forums. If this is consolidated by an international move towards the acknowledgement of any democratic process, regardless of the result, then this will certainly help reconcile the Palestinian society at large. I hope I didn't make you bored so far. Shall I go on?
I think you will have more time, answering the questions of our audience. I believe, I would like to comment on your last sentence about the Palestinian-Palestinian conflict. I believe, as you mentioned before, we went through a democratic process, but we do not have tangible democracy in Palestine. And in order to implement this democracy and to have tangible, substantial democracy in Palestine, I think the loser needs to be abide by the rule of the game. Once you set up a process, you need to be abide by the rule of the game, regardless who is the winner and who is the loser. Okay, let's see our audience and let's have their questions. Yes, we have Edward here. Excuse me. Could you introduce yourself?
Edward Atkin. I'm the Atkin.
Atkin of the Atkin.
I'd like to ask a question to all three speakers. What would you say would be the Arab template for a new Palestinian state? Which Arab state that exists at the moment would you most like the new Palestinian state to resemble?
Why?
I'd like to ask the last speaker, Dr. Savan, in particular, about the question I posed to the Israeli ambassador, the separation barrier. I'm quite interested in the economic consequences for the Palestinians for the separation barrier, because that wasn't mentioned by the ambassador at all. And also, what is the current view of the Palestinians themselves on the settlement issue? I mean, what right now, today?
Thank you. I'd like to raise an issue that wasn't raised by the Israelis.
Sorry to disturb you. Could you introduce?
Sorry, yeah. Can you hear me now? Yeah, I'd like to raise an issue that wasn't raised by the Israelis, which was the Supreme Leader in Iran gave a fatwa that the atomic bomb was un-Islamic. I was wondering what the panel felt about that.
have one more question.
Well, I've been introduced before, so no need. First of all, Mr. Katana, regarding the Jordanian option, it is not any official stance of the Israeli government, neither the Confederation, the Jordanian Confederation, nor the Jordanian being the Palestinian home. It is just as relevant as one member of the Jordanian parliament burning a flag within the Israeli flag in the parliament. It happens, it's very radical, it shouldn't happen, but it's in no way it's the stance of the Israeli government. And Mr. Saddam, regarding the refugee issue, and the rest of the panel, one of the biggest fears of Israelis is that the implementation of the demand for what is referred to as the right of return means the end of the State of Israel. This is the reason why Israel demands the recognition of the Jewish state. We don't need you to recognize our religion or our faith, but rather our existence as a sovereign, independent country. In the implementation of the right of return would mean the end of it. Thank you.
Would you like, Dr. Shokri, would you like to respond to the first question?
Edward, I think my answer is none. If you ask my personal view, I would like a new Palestinian state to be a new Arab state, much more democratic, open to the world, and so on. But I have to say that this is a secondary concern. As our friend here, just arriving from Ramallah, has said, the main concern of Palestinians is end of occupation. Now, end the occupation, build a Palestinian state, and then we'll leave it. We will help the Palestinians. Everybody should, and I don't think, you know, the Arabs only will, but everybody else will help the Palestinians in order to get them to the kind of state that is modern and open to the world and all of that. But if the Palestinians choose to have a Ba'athist state, frankly, that's their problem. You know, they're going to suffer, not us. For Israelis, for the Israelis, all they are entitled to is full and honest and implementation of peace agreement with the security chapters in it, in good faith. You need international guarantees and presence and what have you. And all peace agreements and security arrangements are not based on the niceness of your neighbor. Remember, Syria and Israel have a very solid security relationship, and it's been there for more than 30 years, probably 35 now. No, I'm just, you know, in case this is, you know, the sous-entendu of the question, then whatever the state is, this is why I said this is some of the irrelevant things, whatever the state is, whether it's nice or, you know, the president eats his subject, it's their problem. Our problem is neighborly relations.
I think, Edward, you are just like a good lawyer who asks a question and already knows the answer. And I think I know the point behind your question. And my answer would be, why not, with all due respect to what Azzedine has just said, why not to have a state model, a role model, in the next or future Palestinian state, so that all the Arab neighboring countries will learn from this new Palestinian state. I think this could be fair enough for all of us.
What do you think,
Mr. I think I would like to massage your ego a bit, since we talked over coffee. I would like to say that a technology-based state, be it a banana state or an orange state, would have to be the state that replaces politicians. I think this is what you're aiming at, right? You don't want any politicians in a state. But surely the state that Palestinians would look for is a state of hope. Because that's one thing, one component that's long been missing. Do you want me to answer your question?
Yeah, we have three more questions. We have a question about the separation wall and the Iranian atomic bomb and the refugees issue and the Jordanian option. Probably Mr. Katarni would like to talk about the Jordanian option.
The Jordanian option is My friend, I like it whenever you want to talk about and highlight the Israeli democracy, you do so, and the undemocratic nature of our country also is very basically known to you. So when it comes to a Jordanian parliament, I don't think that, you know, really matters a lot in the decision making at the end of the day. Whereas in the Israeli Knesset, when you have a 58 members of the Knesset talking and highlighting this Jordanian option in a democratic state like Israel, this should raise a concern. So that's why we think, you know, and we took it seriously, that this number of Israeli members of the Knesset consider the Jordanian option as the only way forward in the peace process. You're raising your eyes as if you haven't. I know that 58 members of the Knesset suggested basically a law that will lead into recognizing Jordan as the ultimate homeland of the Palestinians. Well, I'm not good Well, if you come to me with well, it never happened because you know for a fact in this session nobody voted for it, then I will reconsider my knowledge. But if I don't know the exact date, that does not mean it didn't happen. 2 months ago. 2 months ago. Thanks.
Could we move on and?
There is the Islamic bomb.
Yeah.
I don't personally, not an expert on that, but I don't think there is a bomb that can be Islamic or Jewish or
you
anything. The fatwa said that the atomic bomb is un-Islamic, right? Yeah. So I don't know how it can be Islamic. So the fatwa is great. But I think there is a problem with the nuclear program. Everybody knows there is a problem with the nuclear program. But this problem is not going to be resolved in isolation of what is happening in the region. You need, and this is why I said in the hypothetical DOP, you need also to address the security arrangements in the region, because the Middle East doesn't have any arrangement for security. And it's one of the hottest zones in the world, and ironically enough, there is no arrangement, there is no set up or rules or values that are shared by all its states, and we need to start work on this, including on the nuclear dimension. Just to finish the other question on refugees, I think it would be, as Saidun said, it's probably a better idea to go back to the old formulation. And what Tzipi Livni tried to do in addressing the refugee issue through the sudden reference to the Jewishness of the state is not very successful. Because the minute you say, I want you to recognize Israel as a homeland of the Jewish people and so on, you actually ask the other side to recognize your narrative and to abandon their narrative. And we know that in conflict resolutions, it is impossible for each side to abandon the narrative. This is going backward. So the formula that was used until Livni came up with this was, each side recognizes the right of the other to live in peace and security. Recognition of Israel as a sovereign, independent state. Its right to live in peace and security. Look forward, not backward. And let the population of Israel and of all other states self-determination, basically.
Have two or three more questions.
Sure. On the separation barrier, the separation barrier, I gave you the dimensions, so it's running double the size of the Green Line. It has 60 gates. Each gate opens 20 minutes a day, just to allow kids and farmers into their land and kids to go to their schools. So you could imagine the kind of life Palestinians are living, especially that the wall is cutting through Palestinian territory, circling settlements, carving them out, and then going straight back into the Green Line, and then coming back whenever there's a settlement, wherever there's a settlement. So the economic implications is beyond belief, and you can imagine how the Palestinian economy went from deficit to deficit. And these are the figures that I mentioned earlier. You did mention, you did ask about the position on settlements. I think the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian people have for months on end now saying no going back to peace negotiations until there's total freeze on settlement activity. And if you allow me, Mr. Chair, just to mention something about settlements, there's always this talk about natural growth and about, I think there's been some Palestinians who were quite adventurous in their opinion. They said, okay, we're happy to accept the settlements being there as long as the inhabitants of these settlements recognize that they are part and parcel of a future Palestinian state. But forgetting about this, the idea is that there's no such thing as natural growth settlement. In fact, some Arabs and Palestinians make the mistake by saying the illegitimate settlements. To us, all settlements are illegitimate. And for those who don't know, settlements sit on the 75% of water reservoirs in the West Bank. So it's not the issue of demography versus geography. It's demography versus geography versus water versus air, since I come from the IT field and I know about the telecom frequency spectrum management and the problems we face even in operating the second mobile operator. So it's a big issue that needs to be resolved. And maybe I need to add to your attention the fact that 40% of the naturally grown, whatever you name them, houses are empty. So why would Israel expand settlements but to appease its territorial appetite and address such appetite? There is no explanation whatsoever for confiscating more land, annexing people's farms for the purpose of expanding settlements.
Yeah, shall we have three more questions? Yes, please.
Yes, I understand that the three panelists are supporting unity government with Hamas. And I'd like to understand how exactly Hamas will be part of the peace process and how positive will be the input of the Hamas in the peace process. And I only want to mention to Ezzedine that Hamas began its suicide bombings 2 months, November 93, after the Oslo Agreement, with a huge campaign in 94, when they wanted to sabotage the peace process, not because they were not part of it, because they wanted simply to stop peace process.
Thank you. Let's have the lady.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Dr. Seidem in particular, but reactions from the other on Bibi Netanyahu's comments about the demilitarization of the future Palestinian state, which to my mind would make Palestine the Puerto Rico of the Middle East. How do you interpret this, and is there any room for maneuver at all in, if the aim is two states living in peace and security side by side, there will have to be some provision for the security of Palestinians. Would this necessarily imply Israeli control over the external borders of a future Palestine? And if not, as was raised this morning in the role of the EU, is there any role for international forces or some kind of mediation, certainly over the short term, in order to raise the kind of confidence which perhaps eventually could move us away from this stipulation? So what are your thoughts on this?
Okay, we have three more questions. Could we be a little bit brief because we are running out of time?
Certainly. Gavin McNichol from Eden Intelligence. What is the perception of the extent of the informant network within Palestinian society, and what impact does that have on the ability of the society to exercise itself politically?
Joseph Faith, London School of Economics. Dr. Saddam, you spoke about what the kids in Gaza are likely to come to believe in future years. Perhaps we should also speak about the kids in the West Bank. A few months ago, a computer centre for youth was inaugurated in the PA-run West Bank and dedicated to the memory of a suicide bomber. How do you propose that any progress can be made when such glorification of violence is so prevalent throughout the Palestinian media and education system? I know Dr. Shukri dismissed this as irrelevant, but perhaps when an entire society is suffused with an attitude towards violence, which is one of a very positive attitude towards violence, how do you propose that any progress can be made in the future? Thank you.
Thank you. Tabby, the lady, excuse me.
Thank you very much. Nomi Bayarkov. I'll be very, very brief. My question is primarily to Dr. Izzadeen, but also to the other panelists, and that's about the Arab Peace Initiative. How do you rate the current status of the initiative, and what would you recommend that needs to be done in order to make it implementable? In what way would you can be used as a vehicle to enhance peace? Thank you very much.
Thank you. So could we start from you, Dr. Chokri?
Sure. I think I have two questions. First is your question on Hamas. In case I created this impression, then I will correct it. I do not think it's possible or necessarily a good idea to have Hamas in a national unity government. And I don't think Hamas is interested or was interested in joining a peace process. Now, this doesn't mean that Hamas is the reason why we don't have peace between Israelis and Arabs, Hamas and its sister organizations. They benefit politically from that situation, and they have an interest in perpetuating this situation. If you want to address this, knowing that this is also a political movement with support, you have to create a situation where those organizations have to make difficult choices. Inside Hamas, there are those, we have all heard Khaled Mash'al's vague, ambivalent statements and so on, which I think represent the consensus in Hamas, and this is where the ambivalence comes from. A recognition, a preparedness to accept a Palestinian state on 67 borders, etc. And there are the others. As a movement, they don't have to fight each other now and have the struggle because there is no money on the table. They don't have to make a choice. So they can continue with the ambivalence and gather support from both constituencies. If you create a situation where they have to make a choice, then you will see how it works. And given the fact that we know, all of us, that there is a practical sense among Palestinians, including some of the radicals, and that the Palestinians are in majority in support of a two-state solution, then if you create this in a credible way, and I emphasize credible, you know, not another process, per se, here it is, then Hamas' issue will be dealt with. I think it's not going to disappear. There will always be problems on this side. There will always be problems on the Israeli side. You know, we have Rabin tragic assassination as an example of this. But those are issues we will have to deal with. And as an expert on terrorism, you know that this is probably one of the best ways when you combine, as we discussed this morning, force and political. On Arab Peace Initiative, Naomi, there are two tricks with the Arab Peace Initiative that prevents it, other than the fact that Israel didn't actually accept it, that prevents it from becoming an immediate vehicle for a political process. One is, the Arab Peace Initiative, each one in the 22 has a veto on it, which means Syria has a veto on it, which means if you don't make Syria happy, you can't use it only on the Palestinian track. So if you use the Arab Peace Initiative, you need to act at the Arab-Israeli conflict as a whole and not only on the Palestinian track. The second trick is it is not front-loaded. The Arab Peace Initiative is back-loaded. Everything happens at the end. It's like the old Egyptian movies. So it keeps getting complicated, and then at the end you have withdrawal, and then you have normalization, and everybody's happy. And for political reasons, it's very difficult to reverse this because also there is no trust among the parties, and you can't create trust among the parties. And this is why I think you need to go to the back at the beginning. You need to say, okay, so here is the Palestinian state. It is 67 based. Here is an agreed principles to resolve refugees. Here are all the things you asked for as Arabs. If Israel accepts it and Arabs accept them, then you have to have a recognition now because your demands are already addressed. And then you move to implementation. And this is why I think, again, a clarity on the famous end game has to happen at the beginning.
Thank you. Dr. Saidan?
Just to answer, I have three questions to answer. One on the issue of violence. I often say to Israeli friends, If I know that 50 hours of debate will create an end to violence and create neighbors living side by side in peace and harmony, I will go through that track. But I know for sure that each party will always endeavor to prove that its argument is correct. And this, in world politics, is not the formula for reconciliation. What needs to be done is to recognize that a Palestinian child, with so much pressure on him, his land being confiscated, his father is in prison, his mother is suffering, his land is eaten up, occupation is prevailing, passage of goods is difficult, traveling through checkpoints is impossible, checkpoints everywhere, then violence becomes a natural product of the atmosphere that exists. So for you to keep talking about violence and say, this is a society that's bred on violence, when you look at the so many components that are composing the state of despair that exists, then the solution is not to kill the child, is not to keep on the same rhetoric, but rather to address the situation head on and start disentangling the situation that exists by removing the very cause of this so-called violence, which is occupation. So my message to this audience, end the occupation, end it now. It is the longest occupation in modern times. It is the most expensive occupation. It is the most demanding occupation. It has to end, not for the sake of my children only, but also for the sake of Israel. On the issue of accommodating Hamas, I wish to remind you of an Israeli cleric who once said that God had made a mistake by creating Arabs. Yet his people sit in the Israeli government. They receive the red carpet treatment. And yes, indeed, I'm talking about chess. Avada Yusuf once said, God made a mistake by creating Arabs. Could there be a more extreme, discriminatory comment that's ever made, but yet he is accepted? What we are saying, and I'm not advocating for Hamas because I don't belong to that party. What I'm saying is what Abu Mazen said yesterday to Al Arabiya. We will run elections. If Hamas wins, I will hand over to Hamas. Same is the case with the international community. If we rerun elections in Palestine next January and the result shows that Fatah, my party, is to win, good luck to us. But if we lose, we will have to acknowledge collectively the international community, all those who have come to our democratic process, to acknowledge the two terms, the process and the prevalence of democracy. On the issue of society, on the issue of Netanyahu and demilitarization, I would like to tell you that there's always the discussion of Jerusalem being demilitarized. The issue is not of concern. There was no discussion ever conducted within the Palestinian intelligentsia, nor on the level of the Palestinian street, that we should have a state with a nuclear weapon or a state that has no weapons whatsoever. I think that the emphasis is on having a state, which is a major achievement. Then we will decide on the kind of state, a Vatican-like style of a state, or an Iran Islamic bomb kind of a state. It doesn't matter. The most important thing is to acknowledge the need for having a state. On the issue of demilitarization, there was one reservation on the part of Netanyahu's recent speech in Bar Ilan, in which he had said that he wants a demilitarized Palestinian state. Fair enough, that's his vision. But then he says a state that does not control its airspace. Then what's the point of having a state that does not control its airspace? I keep hearing our Israeli friends saying, we have withdrawn from Gaza. Well, I happened to be the minister at the time who received Rafah from the last Israeli soldier who withdrew on the 13th of September 2005. And I tell you for sure, that's not called withdrawal. It's called redeployment. Why? Because people were enclaved. All cross points were closed. The port was not revived. Palestinians could not operate their port and could not operate their airport. So basically, withdrawal will have to be completed in a way that a state recognizes the different components that compose together its independence. And there could be discussions between the different parties on the nature of a Palestinian state. All that the Palestinians care is really end the occupation. one final point, if you don't mind. I would like to say to this audience that we are not in the position of debating the issue, that this is the Arab panel trying to beat the ex-panel, that, you know, the Israeli panelist. What we would like to see is academia move in the direction of helping the Palestinians help themselves, and helping the Israelis help themselves, and helping the whole region help itself. Now, with so many deaths that happens in the region, we don't even bother to read the headlines. 100 killed in Iraq. Khalas, we're used to it. You know, this was not the case. So we're losing humanity as days pass, and we will have to re-initiate a process through which the academia can engage in noble approaches to end such violence and end occupation.
Thank you. I believe that our friend Mr. Katarni would like to have a...
Yeah, just quick note on Ali's question. And also I will address my colleague Azzedine, and both of you, I really cannot understand how you just can't dismiss Hamas from the picture and just exclude Hamas just as a small actor that is not of really any importance in the game. This is a new reality. Hamas is a new reality. These non-state actors are new realities in the Middle East that we all have to address and deal with, whether we like it or not. But having said that, I would like to remind you that the good thing is these new realities are about, let's say, a kind of a state of mind that correlate with the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Just as much as we don't see a Palestinian viable state, independent state existing, this Hamas phenomena, state of mind, will continue and even get bigger and bigger. Remember, Eli Hamas in Arabic is Harakat al-Muqawam al-Islamiyya, the movement of Islamic resistance. And here underline resistance. If we dismiss or at least get rid of the issue that these people are resisting, then they will disappear. So it's a phenomena that whatever you can you do more than what you did in Gaza? You won't. And Hamas is still there. And it will continue. So to talk about Hamas out of a unity government, Hamas that will be outside of the picture, is just basically, as we say in Arabic, biting the water. We're doing nothing, and in a vicious cycle that will continue, and we'll see no more than basically wishing for the days when we were able or we had the opportunity to talk to Hamas. But now Hamas is a very small genie in comparison in the future of the Al-Qaeda of Palestine, that is not interested in having an extra chair on the table. In fact, it is interested in destroying the whole table. And then Hamas would have become a wish for us. Thank you.
Thank you, and please join me to thank our panelists. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Amar, for chairing the panel. Before you all break up, just four very quick points. First of all, if you want to learn more about ICSR, there's a wonderful brochure which I hope you will be reading very carefully. There's also our publications which you will find at the table there. Please take them, they are all for free, and you can take as many as you want. Secondly, I want to thank all of the participants, not just the panelists here, but all the panelists throughout the day who've really engineered a very, very good conversation, and that's what ICSR is very well known for. So thank you to all the participants who are in the audience, as well as the ones who are on the stage. Thank you. Thirdly, in response to Azzedine, we are not planning to have this conference for another 30 years.
But
we will next year. Sorry?
But you're having it next year.
Possibly. unless you resolve all the conflicts in the Middle East, then we will not have it next year. But you will hear from us. We will try to make sense of all of this. And we will send you a document that we will
produced with the help of our Atkin fellows. And fourthly, and most importantly, let me thank some of the people who have made this event possible. Most importantly, of course, Celia and Edward, who supported this event, wonderful people, wonderful to work with. Thank you very much for helping us. Our four Atkin fellows, Odilia, Ode, Sefi and Amal, and of course the ICSR people who have been working very hard the past few weeks on bringing this event together. That's the volunteers, our students at King's that you've been seeing all day running around. That's Andreas Berg, Ryan Evans, Alex Martin, and most importantly, Katie Rothman, who's probably deliberately disappeared because she doesn't want to get this mention, and she certainly doesn't want to say anything. But she really was crucial in putting this event together. So thank you, Katie, even in action.